ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 14th of November. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. The Liberal and National parties will get together today to settle a joint position on energy policy after the Liberal Party agreed to abandon its net zero by 2050 target. The opposition leader, Susan Lee, says a coalition government would not actively strive to achieve net zero carbon emissions, but if they did achieve it, it would be a welcome outcome. But in what some see as a contradiction, the party still supports Australia remaining in the Paris Agreement. Samantha Dick reports.
With the Liberal Party officially scrapping its net zero emissions target by 2050, opposition leader Susan Lee says it's time to get down to business.
We hope and anticipate we can land after Sunday a joint policy that allows us all to fight the Labor Party.
Three representatives from the Liberal and National parties respectively will today begin talks to hash out the coalition's shared position ahead of a joint party room meeting on Sunday. Representing the Nationals will be Senators Matt Canavan, Ross Cadell and Susan MacDonald. The Liberal side includes opposition climate change and energy spokesman Dan Tehan and Senators John O'Dunham and Anne Rustin, who was among a group of moderate Liberals who argued for keeping net zero. Now that a decision has been made, Senator Rustin described the outcome as a necessary compromise.
I think reality tells us that we were always going to have to come to a compromise, but I'm obviously delighted that we're remaining in Paris.
But Simon Jackman, a political scientist at the University of Sydney, says the Liberals axing net zero is less about compromise and more about capitulation.
If you are the Nats, this is what winning looks like. Yeah, you take this as a win.
Professor Jackman says the National Senators entering negotiations today ought to claim the victory and avoid pushing the Liberals much further than they already have.
And so book this as a win and settle this issue down.
In scrapping a net zero target, the Liberal Party is seeking to frame the government's transition to renewables as a cost of living problem. The coalition says cheaper power prices is at the heart of its energy policy, while Labor's net zero target isn't. Tony Wood, an energy analyst from the Grattan Institute, says Labor left themselves exposed when they promised to reduce household power bills in 2022. But he cautioned the Liberal Party against offering cheaper power bills as an alternative to pursuing a net zero target.
What government should do is put in place the policies to get the lowest possible prices under the conditions that we have to address. And one of them is climate change.
As the coalition's infighting over net zero appears to be entering a ceasefire for now, Professor Jackman says the optics of this week's Liberal Party meetings show Susan Lee may have bigger problems in the months ahead.
With Angus Taylor flanked by Andrew Hastie walking in with surrounded by their supporters, it is a stalking horse for a leader who is fundamentally weak, but in a party that is at a historic low level and I think is rather sort of floundering to some extent, trying to find its way.
Political scientist Simon Jackman ending that report by Samantha Dick. So the Liberal Party has unveiled its new policy, but can they sell it to voters in order to win back seats? I spoke to Dr. Jill Shepherd, who's an associate professor in politics at the Australian National University. Jill Shepherd, will this policy change help the Liberals win back seats?
Look, I don't think it's going to shift any votes. Maybe it will shift some Conservative voters to the Liberals, and maybe it will lose some progressive, moderate-leaning Liberal voters to the Teals or back to Labor. But I think in net terms, it's probably a wash electorally. What it will do, though, is allow the Liberal Party to coalesce under a slightly more right-wing position than Susan Lee would prefer, I think, as a moderate herself. But that's the nature of the Liberal Party at the moment. And it will also probably allow them to go into the next election in 2028, most likely, with a clearer framing around economic responsibility, keeping the cost of living down, all of the things that hurt them in May this year that they really are desperate to get back on top of going into the next election.
So there's no net zero target, but the Liberals are pledging to lower emissions year on year. Won't voters in city seats see that as an effective means of actually tackling climate change?
Look, the Liberals are trying to really speak out both sides of their mouth here, and I think a lot of voters who are worried about climate change will see through that and won't be convinced by this sort of avowed commitment to both lowering emissions but not net zero. I think a lot of those voters, though, have already left the Liberal Party. They have already parked their votes with Teal Independents or with the Labor Party, and so these aren't voters who were necessarily voting for the Liberal Party because of their climate change policy. If they were still with the Libs, it was in spite of their position on energy policy. So I don't think that really presents much of a problem for them. The bigger problem, I think, will be down the line if this position that they have at the moment to stay in Paris, but also not to keep lowering emissions targets, starts to unravel, because I think energy policy experts will tell you now that that's not necessarily even possible.
The Coalition says its priority in all of this is to lower energy costs for Australians. How will they argue that stepping away from net zero will make power bills cheaper?
Look, I think they'll have to hope that voters don't look too hard into that. And luckily for them, voters are very busy and they're getting about their days. They don't necessarily know whether the domestic government can lower energy bills, but a commitment to try to do that, I think, will be taken well by a lot of voters. Not all voters. Remember that, you know, there are some voters who will be voting on the basis of climate change action and then others who won't be. And so as long as they can keep pushing that message that even if this doesn't work, they're trying and that they understand, that may have an electoral win for them.
Do we know if voters pay attention at this stage of the electoral cycle, or is it more to do with how the parties prosecute the argument when it comes time to campaign?
Australian voters are barely paying attention at election time, let alone 2.5 years out. So I don't think there's any sense that voters are watching the news, you know, waiting with bated breath to know what the Liberals' position on net zero is going to be. The bigger problem for the Liberal Party is how this plays into a perception of competence, and competence is where elections are won in Australia. So if we go into 2028 and the Liberals have found themselves caught in knots trying to prosecute two cases simultaneously, one that they care about climate change, but also one that they are potentially opening new coal-fired power plants, that sense of competence becomes much harder to convince the voters of. So they may be creating a bit of a landmine for themselves by reaching this position now, but also they may find a way of being able to prosecute that case in a convincing way.
So the Liberal Party says it would remain in the Paris Agreement, but the leader, Susan Lee, says she wouldn't be afraid of copping criticism if Australia were to be in breach of that treaty. How do you think that apparent contradiction would be seen by voters?
I think the average Liberal voter is pretty happy to stick it to international organisations, whether that's the UN or whether that's COP and the Paris Agreement. Again, you know, if the Liberals are trying to win back teal voters and inner city voters, this absolutely isn't the way to do it. But if Susan Lee is trying to shore up her party room to find a compromise position that maintains her leadership and maybe allows her to win on the next issue, then I think she's probably done a decent job.
Jill Shepherd, thanks very much for joining AM.
No worries at all.
And Dr. Shepherd is an associate professor in politics at the Australian National University. Emails from convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein appear to contradict former Prince Andrew's claims he never met his accuser, Virginia Giuffre. The new details have emerged in a trove of documents released by the US Congress. Democrats there are urging Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor to testify about his friendship with the late financier before Congress. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer is in London. He joined me earlier. Elias, why is the latest revelation so significant?
Well, it all has to do with that infamous picture with the former Prince Andrew. He's on the left of frame, grinning to camera. In the middle is the then 17-year-old Virginia Roberts Dufresne. The right of frame is now convicted sex trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell. He has at least implied, suggested that that photo was doctored in that now infamous 2019 Newsnight interview. It was a disastrous interview with Emily Maitlis on the BBC. However, in this newly released email by Jeffrey Epstein, he says that, yes, she was on my plane. He's referring to Virginia Dufresne. And yes, she had her picture taken with Andrew, as many of my employees have. So that appears to contradict the account of the former Prince Andrew.
And Elias, you've been looking through these documents. Are there any more mentions of the former prince?
There are, and there are actually emails sent by the former prince, now Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, to Jeffrey Epstein after he claims to have cut off contact with the financier. So he claimed to have done that after he met with him in Central Park in late 2010. However, in 2011, there's an email here that's been released by the Congressional Committee that shows Andrew responding to allegations that were put to Epstein, Maxwell and Andrew from a reporter at the Mail on Sunday, which is a tabloid here in London. Now, in this email, Andrew says that he's basically instructing that a very stern denial is issued to the newspaper. He's saying that it should state clearly that I'm not involved and that I know nothing of these allegations. He also goes on to say, I can't take any more of this. Now, this is relatively benign. We know that he's issued denials before. But the significance, again, is that the email came about 4 months after he claims to have cut off contact with Jeffrey Epstein. So again, it appears as if he wasn't exactly transparent around the time he stopped speaking or was at least corresponding with Jeffrey Epstein. And we know that other newspapers in the UK have reported that contact did continue in that period after he says publicly that he was actually estranged from Jeffrey Epstein. So Andrew hasn't been seen since his titles were stripped by his brother, the King. We know that he'll be leaving his residence at the Royal Lodge, but this controversy continues to surround him and doesn't appear to be going away. And we're hearing from royal commentators and insiders that they believe there's more to come.
Elias Kluwer in London. First Nations leaders have expressed concerns over the Victorian government's decision to introduce tougher penalties for youth offenders just 24 hours before signing Australia's first treaty between Indigenous peoples and government. Members of the Indigenous community say they weren't consulted on the government's crime legislation when, on average, 3 in 5 young people in youth detention are First Nations. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
Victoria was once considered the state with the more progressive youth crime laws, but some experts say that changed this week when the Labor government took a tough approach on youth violent offenders as young as 14. Jacinta Allen is Victoria's premier.
The courts will treat children for these crimes like adults, where jail will be more likely and sentences will be longer.
A day later, the premier promised to make big political decisions with the input of the First Nations community, establishing a new permanent political representative and body for traditional owners.
The government of Victoria and the Minister for First Peoples, with the First Peoples Assembly's representatives, signing Australia's first treaty.
CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, Narita Waite, has supported the treaty for years and claims she wasn't told about the Premier's youth justice plan.
It is a deeply flawed move. It is a move that will see us putting children in cells and throwing away the key.
The latest data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare shows of the 845 young people in detention on an average night aged 10 and over, 3 in 5 were First Nations people. It's left experts wondering how the state government will balance its treaty obligations with the Closing the Gap strategy, when its youth justice plan could see more Aboriginal children locked up. Professor Kelly Mensel is a proud Ngadjeri woman and is director of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Initiative at the Burnett Institute.
It seems to be a missed opportunity from my perspective. It could have been the first opportunity to engage with Aboriginal communities in Victoria around something that disproportionately impacts the community.
Dr. Geoffrey Robinson is a senior lecturer in politics at Deakin University. He says Labor's plan to tackle young offenders is unusual and not consulting First Nations people on major legislation that impacts them will have consequences later.
I think it probably reflects very much, I think, contemporary Labor. Indigenous claims and aspirations, you know, have a big position in the party's iconography and image. Crime is something that's obviously causing real fear and alarm in sections of the community. If Labor's going to get elected, you know, Labor has to reflect, I think, the concerns of the community.
Dr. Joel McGregor is a senior criminologist at Swinburne University and says the new youth justice laws won't necessarily prevent crime.
We should be treating Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people in an appropriate way that reflects their community. We shouldn't be trying them in tough-on-crime policies. It's not going to work to take those young kids out of their community.
But Victoria's Premier Jacinta Allen defends her government's youth justice plan and said that it's wrong to link the new crime laws with the treaty.
Kathleen O'Connor reporting. Relatives of a Perth man whose death was one of three linked to the Optus 000 outage say they've been kept in the dark for weeks. Christopher Oliver's family members claim they were not contacted when authorities publicly announced the second fatality in Western Australia and are still unsure how the 49-year-old's death was connected to the telco's failure in the first place. Dorina Zadverna prepared this report.
Christopher Oliver's family say they've been waiting for answers since late September.
We specifically asked them when we found out on the news that day, we specifically asked them, is it got to do with Optus?
That's Daniel, Mr. Oliver's son. He claims he was not told his father's death had been potentially linked to the telco's 000 failure, despite police publicly announcing the death in the days following the outage. Daniel and his mother, Naomi, say they've received little clarity since.
We deserve to know. Yes, no, what's happening? Anything.
The outage started just before 11 p.m. in Perth on Wednesday, September the 17th. A couple of hours later, Mr. Oliver's friend called an ambulance after finding him unresponsive. When paramedics arrived, he was declared deceased. Mr. Oliver's son says police let them know on Thursday morning.
They came to the door and they sort of just said, you know, we're sorry to say, but your father has passed away.
WA police were not made aware of the failed 000 calls until that night. On Friday, Optus revealed there had been a fatality during the outage in WA. The next day, WA police emailed Optus about a second death. Here's what Commander Jodie Pearson said over the following weekend.
Sadly, throughout the course of checking on those 149 West Australians, it was identified that a second person attempting to contact 000 during that outage has died.
This was then passed on to the WA Premier, Roger Cook.
And it is so disappointing about the way that the situation has been revealed, both to government, to the authorities and to the public.
The family are still unsure if Mr. Oliver tried to call 000 that night or how his death had been linked to the outage in the first place. Optus's chief executive Stephen Rue appeared before a Senate inquiry last week and was quizzed about the contact he'd made with the families of three people who died during the outage.
I asked the local authorities to reach out to the families should they wish to meet me in private.
Mr. Oliver's sister, Sarah, says that offer was not extended to them.
The investigation is still ongoing, so I understand that, but I just want to know that the connection is actually there and continue to grieve without having to keep asking so many questions and make so many phone calls.
Meanwhile, WA police did not confirm whether they contacted the family on behalf of Optus. In a statement, a spokesperson said circumstances surrounding the death remained under investigation, adding that officers regularly liaise with the senior next of kin throughout the course of such investigations.
Dorina Zadverna reporting, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. How is it that a neo-Nazi rally targeting Jewish people was allowed to take place on the steps of the New South Wales Parliament? Today, extremism expert Josh Roos explains what's going on with the neo-Nazi groups and why they now need to be banned. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.